Hello again, and welcome to X-Files Diaries. I'm Jen.
I'm Annie.
And today we have a really fun and interesting interview. It's with Julie Eng. Julie is the woman behind all those great behind-the-scenes documentaries on your seasons 10 and 11 Blu-rays and DVDs. She had some really great stories and insights from her work on those. But before we get to that, let's check out our tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are in response to our episode about the X-Files episode Wet Wired. Lots of interesting thoughts on that. Monica File Fan said, love this ep. The vulnerability from not only Scully, but Mulder and Maggie too, really shines a light on how much they mean to each other. And Maggie knows this. And when given a choice between solving the case and Scully, Mulder chooses Scully, a theme which stays strong through the series. Great point, Monica. I like that. I like that point where, yeah, it was all about Scully. It wasn't about getting to the truth. It was just about Scully at that point. And
yeah.
He was happy to kind of lose his chance to find out more if it meant that he could be there for Scully.
I remember we briefly discussed this because we were talking about the strange sort of rhythm of the beats of this episode and how, you know, we get to the climax with Mulder and Scully and then there's still another 10-12 minutes of plot to unfold. And
yeah,
we were both like, okay, well, they couldn't really have put that plot before because then it would come across like Mulder didn't care about Scully, that he was seeking out these answers before he went after her. So it kind of had to play that way. And I think for that reason that Monica just pointed out, It was definitely the right character decision for Mulder as well, because that's where he would go first. So
yeah, exactly. So I love that. Love that's one of the many things I love about the episode. Danny says, one of my favorites. The scene at the end gets me every time. Some of Jillian's best work, and I love that when she doesn't trust anyone, she goes to Mama Scully. I love that too, Danny. It just the relationship between Scully and Mama Scully is one of my favorites in the show, and it's on no better display than in this episode.
It leaves a lot to the imagination, but what gets across is that there is a genuine love and affection between these two characters, which is something that is needed, I think, for a Scully personal life plot line. We needed that throughout the series, so it's very nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. So it's a really great element to the episode. Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. I'm getting slightly better at saying that every time. Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo says, yay, I'm so happy for Jen. Thank you, Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. I think Bibbidi is referring to the fact that I finally finished watching Breaking Bad. Thank you. It was a noble achievement, I felt. We'll be listening to this podcast on my evening walk with my dog tonight. And then Danny adds, me too, love listening when I walk my dog. He gets an extra long walk if I can't stop listening. Well, hey, so happy for you and your dog. If it's anything like my dog, they would just go forever given half the chance.
Our pod is benefiting even the quadrupeds out there. So it's nice to know.
Exactly. I can think of no greater honor. So thrilled to hear that from Bibbidi-bobbidi-boo and from Danny.
I just like hearing you say that, by the way.
I'm getting better at it.
You are. You are.
I feel like this is like my best time saying it. I'll never say it this well again. I had you big time said, I love this episode. I'm with Annie on this one. I've never understood how Mulder makes the connection from the matchbox to the motel. So it was interesting to hear Jen's thoughts. Thank you for the fab work you both do. I always look forward to listening to you both. Thanks. I had you big time. We enjoyed that. On that note, Izadub has some theories. Izadub says, I'm not bothered by the doctor at the motel and the TV technician at the crime scene plot. Here's my theory. The experiment was surveyed and controlled locally by these two goons of the syndicate. The doctor is here to monitor the consequences on people and to cover tracks at the hospital. And when Mulder and Scully are involved, known from the syndicate, he keeps an eye on them. That's why he's at the same motel. I even suspect that some of what Scully sees or hears could be related. For instance, maybe it's really CSM and the doctor that Scully sees in the car of the parking lot. As Jen says, Mulder makes the link with the doctor because of the discussion they had with him at the very beginning of the episode. That's how he connects the dots. As for the TV technician, I think he's here to check and survey and remove the device. Then Mulder shows up, so he doesn't have time to finish the job. He prefers to go away quickly. All is surely weak actions from the syndicate and convenient for the plot, but can make sense. And just to add to that, Christy also had the theory that when Scully saw Mulder with CSM in the car, that it was actually the doctor with CSM in the car. So kudos to Christy and Isda both for that theory. That's a good theory, actually. Yeah. I like that theory a lot. I hadn't thought of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it makes perfect sense.
Well, yeah. And I think that from what I recall, you and I landed on the fact that it does make sense. Like, it adds up. I don't think it ever didn't make sense. I think it's just bad storytelling. It's just it's just too complicated. Like I said, it's like you meet this guy at the very beginning, and then by the time we're reminded he exists, we've completely forgotten he existed. And so there's really no way to make that connection, like that's what Scully's seeing in the car or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, when you think about it in retrospect, that does make sense.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things that, like I said, there are too many elements in this that you can't keep them all in your brain as you're watching. And I don't say that with every X-Files episode. I think that's particular to this one, in my opinion. So,
it's
admirable that she put all of this together and made sense of it, because I think that's, I think that's the case with pretty much everything in the X-Files. I think you could take the whole myth arc and add it up and actually make sense of it. It's just getting there is the trouble. So.
Just a question of how much effort is required on the part of the viewer to get there. I mean, you've watched Wet Wired a few times, so I was still slightly confused about that. It's just a little, maybe just a bit too high a level of difficulty for the viewer on that one.
Right.
I think it probably would have made a world of difference if the doctor had somehow shown up in some fashion partway through the episode, so that we would. So, like you say, from the very beginning to the very end, we needed something to remember him in the middle, maybe.
Yeah. And I mean, I get they want it to be a surprise, I guess. They wanted it to be like what? That guy. But I think it wasn't worth it in this case.
Yeah.
Like, the shock value of that was not worth confusing the viewer. So,
yeah, we don't care enough about that doctor for the shock to be worth it.
Exactly.
It's not like we've grown attached to him over several episodes or something.
It could have been as easy as Mulder and Scully leave the room, and then, like, the camera lingers on that guy for a moment, and he kind of goes, and then we go, ooh, something's up with that guy.
And we
file it away in our brain, like, to think what's going on, because it's the X-Files. Yeah. We already know shady shit is going on, so it's not anyway, that could have been a helpful
I like that idea.
Helpful fix,
something, because it was a very sort of innocuous scene. There was nothing about it that made him particularly memorable. He genuinely just seemed to be sort of just serving a very basic purpose to the plot line.
And they have scenes like that all the time on the show.
All the time.
Yeah.
Doctors and coroners and all kinds of those types.
Mm-hmm.
And it does add to the surprise. But like you say, I'm not sure the surprise is worth the confusion.
Exactly.
Fair enough. But, you know, we still it does little to damage the fabulousness of the episode.
It's true.
And last but not least, from Kathy G. Kathy G. has clarified, I'll take credit, she says, for the colorblind lost art of forehead sweat connection. Thank you, Kathy G. I'm glad that you brought that to our attention.
Don't forget to mention, Kathy is coming in with the receipts, which I appreciate.
Yes, she is.
She has her tweet from 2018. Yes. Verified, Kathy G. You get all the credit.
Yeah, like, well done. I can't find things that I posted like a week ago, let alone things from 2018.
Jen,
so Kathy's got it together.
You know this about me. I find receipts so sexy. That's my favorite thing.
I know you do. It's your kink.
Yeah. It is my kink.
That is awesome.
So I loved it.
So I'm going to read Kathy's tweet from 2018 because it deserves it. It's my opinion that it was referenced in Forehead Sweat, referring to the colorblind stuff. At the end, Mulder tells Scully to taste the goopo first because it might be the lemon lime, which tastes like, you know, but it was red and he couldn't tell because he's colorblind. So kudos. May 26th, 2018. Kudos, Kathy. And I mean, kudos that theory caught on well enough that 3 years later you and I kind of still remembered it. Obviously this was quite established almost as fanon, as they say, or maybe it's canon, I'm not sure, but
it.
it's I love it either way. I mean, I think it's actually like good enough that I'd probably call it canon. But now, I think not many people would have noticed.
Now what they should have done is somehow in the revival brought back Mulder's fear of fire. That would have been yes! funny. That would have been
that
so
would have been
funny.
Perfect, right?
Which makes me laugh because I think in Nothing Lasts Forever, in the scene where they're in the church, David Duchovny makes a joke in one of the bloopers like, oh, I can't get close to my fear of fire, which I found so funny that not only would he joke about that, but that he would even remember it. And I don't.
That is amazing.
It actually doesn't surprise me that David remembered it.
No, that's but David, though, right?
What surprised me is that like Jillian laughs like as if she remembers it.
Yeah. And,
which means she must have remembered it. It's a very cute blooper, but it was just
yeah. It makes me almost wonder if it was a running joke between them for like that whole 25
years. Hey, are we ever going to talk about that fear of fire again? Like it does seem like that. Anyway, it made me laugh.
It's that would have been perfection, wouldn't it? Just to bring that so perfectly sort of full circle, but we'll take what we can get with the colorblind reference. So that in itself was kind of beautiful, and we would have totally missed it if Kathy hadn't pointed it out. So thanks for that, Kathy, and thanks for reminding us, giving us a little throwback to the good old days of 2018 when we had new X-Files episodes. That was a special time, right?
Good times.
Thanks everyone for your tweets. As always, we love hearing from you about colorblindness and anything that you'd like to bring to our attention and any comments you'd like to make. We are at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to finding you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We have a special guest today on the podcast, Julie Ng. So tell us about your journey with The X-Files. How did you start? How did you become a fan? How did you find the show? And how did that lead you into being able to work on it?
Right. So I became an X-Files fan. I think it was, I know it was in season 2 at the very beginning. But I think the first episode I ever saw actually was EBE from season 1, but in French. It was just, channel surfing, and then I don't know what image caught my eye from that, but I just kept, because, I'm from a small town in Eastern Ontario and whatever, just picking up the Quebec channels or something like that.
Wait, but did you speak French? I'm so intrigued. Like, did you understand what you were watching?
Yeah, I do have a pretty strong understanding of French, which is a whole other story. I wouldn't say I'm fluent, but enough to, follow what it was. I'm trying to remember what the scene was that kept me watching. It probably didn't even matter what they were talking about. It was something visual.
They're just so pretty going. I mean, how could you not?
Yeah,
that's one of Jen's favorite episodes, by the way.
I love EBE. What a great first episode. That's an episode I would definitely pick to show someone as a first episode, so I think you lucked out.
Mm-hmm. Even though as a plot in French that would, it's extra confusing because it's a little bit, it's got some mythology going on.
Yeah,
and I didn't see all of it, but it made me aware vaguely of maybe what that was, Au Frontier de Riel, I guess it's in French.
Okay.
And then later on, I was, I fell upon, again, I was only watching pieces of episodes or like channel flipping, and I flipped to Blood. Right when the woman comes to get her car repaired and the diagnostics thing is saying like, he's going to kill you, he's going to rape you. And I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
What is going on? Yeah.
So that intrigued me. And I think it was that I was like, what is this show? And so I actually took note. I'm like, oh, X-Files, it's on at this time. And so I think the next time I ended up catching it was like, I came in like right into where there was this serial thing going on, because it was like Joyne Berry, Ascension, and I guess I skipped Sleepless along because I didn't see that until a little later. But and by the, the end of that trilogy with One Breath, like that episode just completely turned me into a rabid X-Files fan. I became obsessed, truly, truly. Like, I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Nice. Relatable.
So much, so,
that's a good arc to get hooked on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though, that was kind of the first of what they were of a LG arc. So I didn't know, and then there's all these other one-offs, But from that, and the show obviously got quite popular, I feel, It was just starting to get some attention in the genre circles, and then, you know, the huge mainstream. And I was along for it for the whole ride, at least most certainly during the Vancouver years. And then when they went to LA, I think I was going to university and I was a little too busy. Like I followed it, but I wasn't as on top of it. Let's put it that way. But to circle back to the other part of your question, when I became a big fan, you know, I love movies. I've always been kind of interested in filmmaking. And so the one thing I was noticing, because X-Files was a very cinematic show, it was very well, everything was good about it. It was very filmic for that time, for television, that is. And I started kind of noticing, hey, you know, all of my favorite episodes are written by these two guys, Glenn Morgan and James Wong. But I also started to notice the styles of of other writers. And that's not something I was ever used to on television. And it just kind of hit at the right time, my age of when I was interested in it. And I kind of remember being in a bookstore and like reading one of these, you know, sci-fi, like probably Starlog, I think it was one of these. And there was it was the first X-Files article I had read about anything. And it was an interview with Glenn Morgan and James Wong. And then that got me really interested in that aspect of how how a television show is made and how these writers, these styles can have a voice in a medium that isn't really considered a director for a film is kind of like what a writer and a showrunner is in television. And
The X-Files was very unique in that way. You're right, that there weren't a lot of other shows on at that time that had these different sounding voices in the writer's room and the directors.
That was sort of the niche thing, I guess I would say, that I became quite interested. And, you know, as a fan, and this is in the early or mid-90s, so everyone was making their GeoCities web pages and things like that. I'm like, I'm going to make something about Morgan and Wong. Like, I'm going to do a writing thing. And also, how can I forget? And Darren, I was a gigantic Darren fan. So I'm like, well, let's put this all together. And it wasn't as things weren't back in those days, because I had, you know, the 14.4 dial-up modem, it's all text-based. And we were talking about scripts, later on, that was something I wanted to try to collect and find them. I don't even know how you trade among fans. And even back then, like I said, I became a fan in season two, and then it was just a matter of trying to find all these episodes I had missed. Like, you record reruns. There is no DVD box sets, or they only had the VHS of the best of episodes. So, but there were ways. I found some catalog of a guy who was, you know, he had all the episodes on tape in Michigan. I don't know who this. I think in a print ad in the back of some fanzine, and you know, just you go to Walmart, you buy a 10 pack of VHS tapes, and I mailed them to this guy in Michigan who I don't know, and then he just recorded a bunch of them for me. And I was like, I'll pay your postage.
Files helping files.
That's how things worked back in ancient days. You know, so
yes, that's awesome.
So, anyways, long story short, I think maybe before I made that website, one of the things which I know you probably know is a lot of the writers back then, they kind of scoped the message boards and things like that. And by complete luck, it's just complete, the whole thing is just strange luck and kismet. But I had written something on the Alt TV X-Files, which was not even about X-Files. Maybe it was, or I was writing with Darren, I think. You know, it was a long time, a very long time ago. Yeah. But it was something that Glenn Morgan actually saw on the message board, and he responded to me.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's a huge thrill for a teenager who already was a huge fan of his work and who. And we kind of kept back and forth on occasion. Not much, but he would hint at something or that kind of thing. And then, but that developed, basically, he gave me my first break in film. And I worked as his assistant for, and Jim for a few years, almost 20 years ago, and got to know them then.
Was this on the show or on different projects?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, like this, they had left.
This was after they had left in like season 2, whatever it was.
Yeah. So whatever I was talking about at the time was when Darren was on the show. So season 3, I guess.
Right.
And then he had come, then Morgan and Wong had come back in season 4 and then left. And anyway, around 1999, so a few years after that, I ended up working on their first feature, which was Final Destination.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
You know, we got on well. And then the next, which Jim Wong directed that film. And then their next film was called Willard, which Glenn then directed. Mm-hmm. And I think they asked if I would come and do the same job that I did on Final Destination. And I'm like, of course. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I had learned from Final Destination was that Glenn is very, like, I always say, like, low maintenance. You know, when you're an assistant, he didn't really need a lot. Yeah. And so it was great to get to see what they were doing and be in on it. But I was like, how can I be of more use? Or, you know, and I wanted to make films myself. So he was, this was his directorial debut, feature director. And so I had pitched, why don't I make my first movie about your first movie? Mm-hmm. And so he basically, I put that pitch forward, and for whatever reason, he agreed and just kind of let me have full access to, he's like, if things go, you know, he didn't want it to be this cherry coated, like, I feel like that's not the right.
Is it sugar coated?
Sugar coated.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm going to start saying cherry coated. I like cherry coated. I like that. Yeah.
Anyways.
It's all good.
But yeah, so again, so I made this making of document essentially that, you know, kind of showed all the ups and downs of that production. You know, it wasn't a very successful film, but I think it's a good film. And I think the thing that makes that making of a bit memorable, I suppose, is that you're seeing it to its end, because, you know, a lot of making of things are kind of either for promotion or, well, most of the time they are. And you don't see a lot of the nitty gritty of, you know, test screenings and these kinds of things of how a movie, you know, might even fail at the box office and that kind of thing. So at any rate, we made that and then sold it to the company that was making the movie, New Line Cinema. But they had a great home entertainment department who did a lot of, you know, they were making good special features for DVDs. And that was sort of my first inadvertent, like, you know, I kind of fell into it. It wasn't something that I was aiming to do as a career, like these kinds of documentaries. But from that, I ended up kind of, as these things go, you start making more, or they ask you to. So I ended up working on a lot of New Line films. And then one of the guys at New Line ended up moving to Fox and started working on some Fox projects. And then, yeah, you know, having known Glenn and knowing that he might have slipped that, you know, X-Files might be coming back. And I was like,
you're like, right,
you're
going
to be part of it? Yeah, like, you know, and so I was like, it was almost too good to be true.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what, you know, what do I have to do to get this job? Like, so I was born for this.
Yeah.
So I went to the people who I usually work for at Fox. And I'm like, please let me pitch for this, you know. And to their credit, they were like, you know, yeah, we think you would be a good fit. It's just a matter of, it's really up to Chris Carter, who I didn't know.
You hadn't met him, yeah.
I had not met him. So I'm like, well, and, you know, Glenn's like, I can put in a good word, but, you know, it's, I can't guarantee it. And so there was a little bit of back and forth, because it wasn't so much that whether Chris wanted me or not. It was like, we didn't know. A lot of time filmmakers have their own kind of behind the scenes person, right?
Right.
Like, or they get used to, like, even because I've done a lot of Glenn and Jim's projects before. And so, I mean, I don't know, like, because it was really up to, you know, I think I had 2 days before I went to Vancouver when I knew for sure that I had the job. But, like, wow. I was definitely proposing hard, like, and, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
So how does this, how did this sort of work? Like, were you kind of just given free rein to like go around? Like, were you actually working the camera? It was my first question. For a lot of these interviews, like, you're the camera operator for a lot of this behind the scenes footage. Like, what, like, are you using like a, this is so techy and geeky, and I don't even know any of this, but I'm just curious, like, what kind of camera were you using? Like, did you have a crew, or was it all you? Like, how did this work? How'd the process work?
So the process for this project, and often how I work, got really lucky again with Excels, because I got, like, so I made a proposal, and, like, I want to make these things, and so that being documentaries, and then, you know, you pitch documentaries, you pitch the gag reel, you pitch what commentaries you want to do, all that kind of stuff. And I do shoot myself, and I'm an editor. I think I'm an okay camera person, but I actually do it as a means to an end in terms of knowing, because I'm I know I'm going to edit my own stuff for the most part. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this case, we did a lot of content, and I have an editing partner, Mike Lane, who works with me on a lot of this stuff as well. I should mention him, but that, I'm kind of a one woman band. So I, especially on X-Files, that I kind of knew exactly what I wanted. And the benefit was, like, the great good fortune is that I have worked with Morgan Wong a lot, and it was shooting in Vancouver where I've worked on a lot of their projects. So I knew a good number of the creative team. I mean, and then it was a matter of hoping that Chris would be open to it, and he was, and he just, they just said, do what you need to do to cover, and they it was amazing. So
it's a lot of work, like, that
it is.
That really surprises me, yeah, to hear that. You know, you're essentially doing all of this. I mean, I've seen bits and pieces of the documentaries are Season X, which is the first one in the revival, and then Solve for X is Season 11, and the Scully Effect one, but we will talk about that later. But I had seen bits and pieces of them, but I hadn't actually sat down and watched the whole thing from start to finish, which I did. I watched all of them, and I was just so impressed with just how well they're made. And I'm sorry, I'm just blown away by the fact that, like, that's essentially just you, just doing all of that. Like, that's incredible. So bravo, kudos. So,
yes. Because you had one thing. I was on, I guess you would call it the on-set videographer. So I'm on set just capturing the B-roll is what they call it.
Yeah.
You know, the happenings and all that, and kind of hopefully being at the right place at the right time, that kind of thing. As far as interviews go, you know, how I was saying, like, I'm an okay camera. I don't think I'm a great cinematographer. I have basic lighting skills. So, and also when you're interviewing, like, that is very hard. You can't, like, to operate a camera, to worry about the sound, to interview them. I have done that, but in this situation.
Those interviews, though, were so striking. Like, they were really well set up. Like, and I can visualize them in my head during that whole promotional period.
I brought in a crew. I want these to look good.
Yeah.
And I just want to worry about the interview, and you worry about making it look good. So,
And they did. Yeah. I mean, you clearly had, like, a really good rapport. I can only assume with everyone that you interviewed, because everyone seemed really comfortable talking to you and really sort of, like, seemed very sincere and down to earth. And so you obviously made them feel that they could sort of trust you and be open with you.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that came across. You never know, I guess, because it was certainly my first time interviewing David and Jillian, and obviously, being such a huge fan of the show, I was extremely nervous. But eventually.
I think, Julie, the way that you know is that they're just, they seem so relaxed and at ease, and they're smiling a lot. And I remember thinking this because before I knew who you were, or obviously so many fans see these videos and have no idea the people behind them who make them. It's just promotional material. We saw those all leading into, especially particularly Season 11. I remember so many of those interviews and thinking to myself, wow, this interviewer really got some good quotes out of them. Like, I don't know. I particularly remember the one that went around where Jillian's like, well, everything's pretty much the same, except the sexual tension's gone because we have sex. And she gives, like, that little look to camera. And I remember thinking, first of all, who allowed her to say that? Chris obviously wasn't anywhere in the room. But second of all, I was like, that whoever was asking you got something really good out of her. And that would be you. And that's amazing. It's so cool.
That was a highlight. That was, you know, that's when, you know, like she says it and I had to pause and clearly that's gold. That's going to get used. And the thing is, for that piece, one thing I should mention, because you're right, it was for publicity. I got to do these interviews, because I was there on site and I was extremely lucky, the situation, because I was brought in from Home Entertainment. So, because again, I am usually on the DVD side. Like, I like to make long form, as you know, those are long pieces. And I mean, yes, it's publicity, but it's meant to be consumed after you've seen the show. And then, you know, Fox has a publicity department, their own editors and producers who need to make things that are for pre-release. And so what ended up happening on X-Files, which is, I think, very rare, usually it's the other way around, where the publicity people come into production and then me as the DVD person tries to hop on to I send them their question. Yeah, I send them questions for me, right, and hope that there's time, kind of thing, and whatever, so they get whatever they want, and then if I can get in a few things that are a little deeper in content or whatever, deeper, I just mean, you know, longer than a 5-minute kind of thing, but it was reversed on the revival seasons, where they said, just get your lead to, send the questions, and she'll just do it all at the thing. So that thing that you mentioned with Jillian, that was for sure a question from publicity. They wanted to get a tease of, tell us where Mulder and Scully's relationship is at. And then, so she just knew how to sell that.
It's so great. And I imagine that these were interviews. I mean, you got to interview so many different people. And I was kind of trying to notice throughout the whole documentary, both of them, obviously 2 different years, but they were in different outfits. So it must have been different sessions. It wasn't you just sit down with Jillian, we're going to do a big thing. You were going back, I'm assuming, throughout the filming and getting their different takes at different times. And then there obviously is a lot of that B-roll footage you're talking about, where you're actually getting them behind the scenes and they're talking, and you get this sort of real-time vibe during the times that they're filming. And I found that really fascinating too, and I love the way they wove that all.
The editing blows me away. I mean, I am by no means an editor, but I attempt to edit this podcast, and so I just know a tiny bit of editing, but the whole time I'm just this is so well edited, because I mean, that's kind of how you tell a story with a documentary, right? I mean, you've got to get all that content, but it's how you put it together that makes it interesting to watch. And just the really cool stuff you did, having the split screen a lot of the time, was really interesting. It's I was ooh, twice the content.
Yeah,
I like
more
this.
Stuff to look at. That's, yeah, yeah.
What ended up being. I had so much content, I'm like, I can't choose. I'm just gonna have to go to
I like
but,
it.
And that's what a I fan would do. Like a fan would
give
find
it to, give it all to
yeah,
us.
Yeah. Find a way to and really not making it confusing or anything. I mean, no, it's not like you're watching picture in picture where your mind is distracted by two things. It was just very well put together, where
it just
you're not
worked.
Yeah.
It worked. Like if someone had said, "Oh yeah, there's going to be a lot of split screen," and I would have been like, "Oh my head." But no, it somehow just really all worked really well together. Occasionally, I would rewind just because I really wanted to examine both halves of the screen. But it's just really interesting.
There's a lot of stuff in those split screens that I do think sometimes it goes fast, but there are I picked certain things because I knew they were a little different, or there was a little detail that sometimes I have a feeling probably go over a lot of people's heads, especially the first time, because you're listening to the interviewer or the interviewee.
Yeah.
All that. But
There's so much content just packed in there. You had the wonderful technique of showing those little story cards, and I wanted to read every one of the cards. And so I'd always sort of stop listening while I was reading the card, and I'd be like, okay, I got to go back now and listen what someone said again, because I loved those cards. They were so cool. Were those all real story cards that you used?
Yes. So I've always, going back to what I was saying, how I became my entry into Wildham was sort of in the writing. It's kind of been lore to me, I guess, how the X-Files writers broke stories with these index cards. And I really wanted to do something about the index cards. I kind of feel that I didn't do what I didn't ultimately achieve what I was going for, but it was the idea that, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar or you've read about how the writers kind of board their stories with index cards.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You did a fine job.
You did an excellent job.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
In the documentary.
And it was like an ode to Glenn, which I think is cool. I mean, because that was his and Jim's sort of thing that they brought to it, right? Like,
right.
That's, I mean, and it is a great way. I have definitely read about that in the X-Files lore about how they used to break stories, but I feel like I just keep like praising you, but I do think that you explained it like even better than I had already known, because it was like the idea of like, and everybody, like you would be interviewing like Kristen Cloak and Shannon Hamblin, and they would be talking about how, yeah, well, if we don't like this, we just throw it out, and then we don't need to worry about it anymore. And I think one of them, like Darren, was saying that, yeah, if it's on a card, I have to keep writing it and keep using it and keep looking at it, and then it's something that is kind of imprinted in my brain.
Yeah. Like a visual thing.
Yeah. Right. Like things.
And it doesn't have to be too, you know, too much information for him.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
But the thing about the index cards that I found really interesting, like from interviewing, that I'm not sure gets across in that piece, is that they make sure that everything is on the cards before they can even go and write the script. Like it has to be like the board has to be rock solid.
Yeah.
Right. And so I found that interesting, like, you know, you have to know your beats, mm-hmm. even if it's just, you know, condensed into that. And what I was going for with Solve for X, which is like when I was saying I'm not sure if it came across, was originally what I was going for was and it's a story I know Glenn says all the time, but that they were trying to come up with episode ideas. This is back in season one or two, and Morgan and Wong had been watching some nature documentary, and a snake ate a deer whole or something crazy like that. And he was just like, Howard, you should put that in your episode. Well, you know, snake eats a guy, not a deer or something like that. And I don't know the details, or I don't remember the details of the story anymore. I do remember the snake eats a guy.
Yeah.
And then he said, like, I wrote that on a card, and you look at the board and you just plop it at the end of act three or something like that. And then you write everything around, this is for Diane.
Yeah.
But
that's like the focal point, and then the story kind of comes from that. Yeah,
goes from there, and even cool. Even if that's not the most important scene, that's what was like the origin point, or like the what the fuck moment kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get what is the snake eats a guy beat for each, or for whoever has had one of those in season 11. That was what I was going, and some had them, and some didn't, and so that's why like I just kind of use them a little more broadly.
Right.
And I would have focused on the snake eats guy for each episode, but I'm like, oh, I want to talk about more things. So
I wonder if they have that card somewhere, like in a frame in their house or something.
Snake eats guy. Yeah.
They should.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love the cards. I'm so glad you use them for so much throughout the document, both documentaries really, but especially Solve for X, because you sometimes learn interesting little tidbits of how the story was originally conceived, and it may or may not have come across exactly that way on the screen, or we maybe weren't always sure about what the intention of the scene was, but the cards really sort of nail it. So I was thrilled that you used them as much as you did.
Great. I'm glad that you noticed. Because most of the ones that I used were specifically that exact. And I'm like, oh, I think people would want to know that this was the idea, or, you know, how is Chris going to imply that Scully is pregnant? Or look, Darren wrote a thing there that, you know, suggests that Dagoo's in the scene. Those ideas were there.
Let's talk about that, because speaking of cards.
We have to talk about Dagoo.
I have a quote unquote card on my Google Doc that just says very big Dagoo, because I want to ask somebody who was there on the set, constantly around these people, what's the deal with Dagoo? Because I did read the same thing you're saying, is that like it was considered that he would be around, I think, for what, Lost Art of Forehead Sweat or one of those episodes. And then for whatever reason, they just didn't put him in there. In my head canon, my mind, he's there and he's just upstairs
Dagoo
and he's asleep.
Is there.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what was was that ever even discussed, or was it just kind of the dog's gone? Who cares? Like what? Like, I want to know. I'm so curious.
We're very big Dagoo fans.
Yeah.
I feel bad that I don't have a good answer for that, because, you know, that's a question that I feel like, you know, as a fan, I should
that's
know.
All right.
But obviously, the card implied, and I think it's possible, you know, early in a production meeting, like, is this dog coming back? And they said, so like, possibly, but then I don't know if it was just logistics. I mean, trying to get a similar dog back.
I'm sure you're aware of like the continuity nightmares on this show.
Yeah.
And like, it's just one of those things that it's
we can
like,
talk about that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, we've talked about that a lot, Julie. But whatever you want to share, please do. I remember thinking, and I know Jen, you agree with me that like when you're watching Weremonster and like Scully takes the dog, like, okay, if we're going to have Scully take the dog, we need to address that. Like, it's just, it's so frustrating because it's like, it's
super. We want
super,
to see Dagu again.
It's so easy for her to just not take the dog. Like, you know, like, can't she just be like, you're a cute little guy. You remind me of Queequeg. Cut. End scene. Like, but no, we have to show her taking the dog. And so now we need to know, is Scully a dog abandoner? Like,
very unresolved.
Yeah. And it seems like that could have easily been resolved with a line or something. I don't know.
They could have just put a dog barking, right?
A barking would have done it. They underestimated the emotional connection that we were going to have with Dagu, that we really wanted to know more about him. But I was thrilled to see that his name did show up on one of those cards for Lost Art.
That was worth pointing that, you know, it was thought of.
Yes.
That's so, enough for me.
The weather,
so,
logistics, you know, and another, just I just remembered when you brought up Dagu. It was kind of a funny moment. I think it was in a version of the gag reel, but didn't end up in there. But that vacuum cleaner,
The Roomba.
The Roomba or whatever it was. What is it, the off-brand name on the show? It wasn't
It was, what was that
Zooms.
Called?
Zooms.
Zooms.
Yeah. Something like that.
I like that. That's really funny that you brought that up, because we actually just got a Roomba like a month ago.
Oh my God. How could you get that after watching that episode, Annie?
Well, I actually didn't think about it. I should have. But we have a golden retriever, and this dog sheds like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And we're at home all the time now. And so I'm just like, I can't deal. I need something. I can't pull out the giant vacuum three times a day. I'm not going to do it. Let me tell you guys, this is not a Roomba has not paid me to say this. But I love this thing. That's all I have to say. I love it. I don't care if it comes to life and tries to kill me, because it's worth it. So
that's the tagline for the marketing campaign,
exactly,
right there.
Exactly.
I don't care if it comes to life and kills me.
If
it's
the
worth
machines
it.
Do take over, I hope this is the first one, because then at the very least my house will be clean. So
nice. I'm taking all of this and sending it to them to use for an ad, because it's an awesome ad.
Oh, that was quite a tangent, and I apologize. But
that was great.
I enjoy.
That was really interesting.
Oh no, just that when the vacuum comes towards her in a shot, I do recall there was one moment where I think they got the shot, but Jillian started naming the vacuum Dagu.
That
was where
I love that.
She was wondering where he was too.
That is my favorite. Okay, that is my favorite tidbit that I've heard on this podcast in a long time. I love that.
Yes. Anything Dagu related, we just suck it up like a vacuum cleaner.
It's so, those little details, we live for those. I love that. Jillian is, of course, Jillian's
awesome.
Like, where's the dog, guys?
Jillian
I miss
has
that
Dagu
dog.
In her heart.
Yes.
And that makes me feel happy.
I love that. I love that.
That's awesome. Can I change the subject for a second and go back to just sort of another sort of logistics question for you, Julie? When you're doing all that wonderful B-roll behind the scenes at the actual on site, were you there like for the whole day of filming every day, or how much time did you spend on set?
Yeah, I kind of was there almost all the time, which is not common on any project.
Well, you don't want to miss
anything. Sustainable for a budget. And all these things, but because I was, you know, my own producer, and like I was the producer hiring me as a camera person, I'm like, I don't care, I'm gonna stay here because no one's telling me to leave. And so it's truly because I'm a fan. Like I just like, if I can be here and no one's telling me to leave, I'm just gonna keep coming.
I would do the same. So I approve of that.
Yeah, long days though.
So they were long days. And I, you know, I wasn't there every single day, but I was there for most of it, and certainly for season 10. Season 11, I had a lot of other, it just felt like I was busier for whatever reason, still on X-Files, but like I just couldn't, and they were often a especially in the latter half of production, a lot of things were happening simultaneously, and it's like you just had to pick where to be, and that was painful.
There's only one of you.
Which one am I going to cover? And obviously, if it was anything with Mulder and Scully, I'd try to be there. And
You got some really amazing.
I don't know.
Footage.
It's I'm lucky that they were okay with me because being around. That's one of the tricky things of just that position in general, regardless David Julian or any actor. You know, you need to be sensitive of what their preferences are. And the big thing as a behind the scenes camera person is all about eye line. Like, you don't want to distract them from doing what they're doing. And, you know, every once in a while, even if they're not telling you to get lost, sometimes I feel I'm too close or something like that. And you just gotta,
that's being a good producer. Like, you're kind of aware of when you need to back up. Yeah.
Kind of awareness. And, you know, and I'm not pushy. And I like being fly on the wall. Like, I don't get in there and say, hey, talk to me on the camera. Like, I just want to film what's going on, and I'm invisible and they don't even look at me. I'm kind of happy with that. So,
It feels very much like a fly on the wall when you're watching those documentaries, that it's just like, there's no sense that you're like inserting yourself into the scene, that genuinely feels like I'm standing there just sort of watching them work, and that it's just the real deal, which obviously it is. And there must have been like a really nice sort of bond of trust with you that they could just go about their business and not worry about what you were doing or how you were going to portray them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I have no idea if they've or not, to be honest. I mean, I know these scenes, parts of it that have to get, you know, cleared for legal reasons or whatever. But I spoke to David in season 11, and he himself mentioned, he's like, hey, I never saw the things that you made. And at the time, I was like, do I send him a link? Or what if he thinks like I reveal too much and then he kicks like, yes,
like, let him figure it out. Yeah. Okay, wait. So,
that's a bit tricky.
But speaking of David and Julian, I have to ask you, Julie, for posterity on all future files, are you the person who caught on video David and Julian hugging after My Struggle 4, saying I love you to each other? Was that you?
Yes, it was. I mean,
Bravo. And he turned around, he's like, oh, they got that on tape. They're on to us. We can't fool everyone into thinking we hate each other.
You really want to give people their privacy, obviously. Yeah. And know when they're talking about, you know, they're just like shooting the shit in the corner. I'm not going to film that.
Right.
But it's flash shot. And in my mind, I'm like, I'm pretty sure she's not coming back to the show ever again.
Yeah.
I have to follow.
It's iconic.
And, if she tells me to get lost, I'll get lost, kind of thing. But it was funny because I think she was saying her goodbyes, and I think she's going to go to where David was, in like whatever green room that was. And I kind of remember, I was like, yeah, do I follow in or do I just like, leave it? And I think Dina Green, who is David's hairstylist, she's like, get in there, Julie. So I'm like, so I just like, I used that and I went in.
Thank you, Dina.
I wasn't like, you know, right in there.
No,
it was great.
Then David was like, it's funny because, I've watched that, whatever he says.
Yeah. Oh,
that was caught on tape or whatever.
Yeah.
And she's like, that it was. And I'm like, yeah, that, sorry, you know, here I am, kind of thing.
Hi.
Kind of wait.
Hi.
This is the last of it.
You're like that little meerkat just going, boop, like popping up. Hi, I'm here. I love that.
It's so good. I love it. That's so great.
They tolerated me. I don't know whether, you know, how much they love having a, you know, camera around all the time. But like I said, I think I'm respectful in terms of when to roll and when to not. And it's usually, you know, I'm what I really do genuinely care about is how the episode's getting all the business. So.
It's just, it was a fun, nice little sweet moment. I'm really glad you captured it. I think millions of other people would agree. We're all glad you captured it because there was a lot of, I mean, we don't need to talk about this, but it feels like there was a lot of weirdness going around with that finale and like the vibe and everything. And so to see moments that were positive was just, it was very nice to see that. So I thank you, Julie, for getting in the space that you weren't really in and getting that on tape for all future. I will cherish it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I wanted to give you props for, like I said earlier, like watching these documentaries really feels like the person who made them is a fan, because there were just like, in particular, I think the Founders Mutation section in season X, when you were using footage from, like, what was it, Little Green Men, like the older episodes of like Samantha being abducted and like comparing it to the newer ones with William, the quote unquote William sure. being abducted. It was just so cool to watch that, because I'm like, you know, if they just had hired some random person to come on and make this documentary, they wouldn't have pulled that footage, or they wouldn't have known right where to go and to pull up the proper footage to make those comparisons. And I just thought that was really neat of you to do. And you did stuff like that throughout, which as a fan, I really appreciated that.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, one example of that that I was really happy with was, you know, in Mulder and Scully Meet the Weir Monster, the scene when Mulder's like pacing back and forth in the room and rambling about it's a monster, blah, blah, and she's just sitting there, can't get a word in edgewise. That scene, I actually wasn't there that day. No, I was there, but that was the day we were, those interviews that you were talking about, that one of the days where I was getting a bunch of cast interviews. So I was sort of like holed up in a room somewhere else waiting for them, like when they were available for 20, 30 minutes or something, to, so they would be sent up to me. But while I'm waiting, I can't be on, well, I wasn't on set shooting. So I was missing that scene. And I, as I mentioned, it's like, I hate missing Mulder and Scully interactions. And that's a good one.
That was a good one.
One of the things that I tried to get in there a lot, it was sort of in relation to doing the gag reel. But when you're looking for bloopers, because no one in the editorial of X-Files had made a gag reel. Like the ones that we see on YouTube, they were made in house, like
for the cast the and the crew and
for
stuff.
The cast. Yeah. It was like private, right? Like,
yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah. It felt private.
For sure. Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
But they kind of, you know, as fans, like everyone loves those videos.
Yeah.
And they're really funny. And yeah. I felt like we have to have one, even if it's like the Fox sanctioned one. And, you know, by the future, and I Want to Believe had gag reels, so I'm like, well, let's try to continue with that. So I asked editorial if, hey, have you been setting aside bloopers? Because, you know, then I can assemble that. And they're like, no, no one did that, or no one had time, or whatever. I'm like, no. Like,
yeah, no, can you imagine? Can you imagine being the person with blooper footage of Mulder and Scully and being and like, nah, throw these out. Oh my God.
But, so I'm like, we have to have this. So I managed to, you know, I worked it out where I was able to get access to dailies. So I would scan through everything looking for it myself. You know, it's a dream job for a fan, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of footage to have to go, yeah. Like, you know, it's like every take.
God. And this is like after you've been on set all day, too.
Yeah, actually, this was done after. Like, there's no. Done,
you would
like,
do this
know.
After. Okay.
So
yeah.
During editorial, I would be, like I was talking about, Mike and I would. Set some time aside and scour through the stuff and like mark the thing, and then so we're basically making a request list editorial to pull for us, kind of. But as you're going through that, you're finding a lot of other interesting little bits, you know, if they're still rolling from behind the scenes, of which a lot of is in these documentaries. And one of those was when Darren says, you know, I want more energy, or I don't know what it is he says, and then Jillian off camera says Rock from Mars, and then David's like Rock from Mars, and I'm like, I know what that is. I don't think any other person would know what that is.
Yeah,
that was an example. You know, I can't believe I found that, because it fit into the whole episode, like because it was a tribute to Kim.
Yeah,
and that was the same episode where his tombstone was like it all kind of fit in a weird. It was anyways.
It was serendipitous.
Was just,
yeah,
a very serendipitous bit of.
That's so great.
That was cool. That was very
yeah. So. I wanted to say too. Jen pointed out, because she texted me a couple nights ago, because she got to this before me. But she's like, "Oh my God, did you see this awesome nod to Vince that they put in the Band-Aid Nose Man's?" Which I never ever would have noticed if it wasn't like David like tapping on it or something. It was like in the where it was like the tortoise with the head on top. It was like it was a Breaking Bad homage, and I never noticed it And I'm a huge Breaking Bad fan.
Loved it. I'm just watching Breaking Bad right now, so I'm in the mode. And I'm also a really big Vince Gilligan fan as well. So seeing that part in the documentary, I was like, oh my God. And I immediately had to stop and go and check the actual episode to see if the prop made it into the episode. And there it was. So I said to screen cap to Andy saying, there it is. Yeah. It's actually there. Nice. So thank you for that. I loved it. Yeah. That was a really great moment. Just all those little tidbits that I think that you being a fan, fans can tell when things are made by fans, I think, because you just get what we're looking for. And that was just one of many examples of just little tidbits that I love.
I have a random question that is about, again, maybe things you might have picked up on or overheard about the storytelling process, or, you know, if you were in the writer's room or anything like that. This whole, like, this man thing in season 11, how they kept putting that in all the episodes, like, I feel like they've always just said, we just thought it was fun or whatever. But did you ever pick up on the idea that, like, there was a deeper meaning to that? Or do you have any of your own theories on that?
I don't. Well, I know that I kind of know a little bit of that backstory in that, again, it comes from Glenn. Because do you know the backstory of the
Yeah, the idea of this man, it's sort of being like, I mean, long story short, in relation to the idea that this is like a dream, this is like a man you see in your dreams or whatever. And so, you know, obviously the internet's like, oh, is this some coded message? Are they trying to tell us? But it wasn't in every episode. And so I was trying to be like, if it was, I didn't see it in every episode. It was in most of them.
Well, I think that it was sort of an in-joke at first, because Glenn's daughter, I think, had sent, I hope I'm getting the story right, but I think she just sent like the picture of this guy's face. And she's like, oh, I just learned about this, whatever, if it was an internet meme or.
Yeah.
And right. He thought that was kind of creepy and cool. And funny story, it is funny and it's not funny, is that one day I was driving, like, I was on the highway, and he texted me this man. And, you know, like, my phone is there for the GPS or whatever. And it was like, bing. And then this, like, this man head, popped on. And it, like, scared the crap out of me. I was like, swerve. That almost killed me.
Oh my God.
But, wow.
The next file in itself.
But he really creeps me up, that face.
Yeah. It is creepy. Yeah.
It is somehow creepy.
But I think it's a thematic motif, if you will, like more of what he was going, because this kind of has this, you know, am I real? Am I, you know, am I simulated? Am I, like, what's going on? And he kind of wanted to feed that in. And then everyone else he's in a lot of the episodes. Like, he's in Plus One as well, actually.
Yeah, Plus One. I think in My Struggle 4 also.
He's in this.
Well, yeah, this wasn't when he was in First.
Yeah.
And I think he was in another. Oh, he's in Lost Art of Forehead Sweat on the board.
Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's in most, I think. I'm sure the fans who
I want to say he's
in
like half. I want to say he's in half, but I could be wrong.
Half.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's definitely there. And there were a lot of fan theories going around that maybe it'll turn out this whole season was a dream or something like that. So it was cool.
If you were to ask me my theory, I think that you can use him to, if you really wanted to perpetuate that, that idea. Like if the whole thing is some kind of crazy dream, or something relating to what's going on with Scully and William. I mean, I haven't worked it out in detail.
Well, see, I'm open to that theory, but like, I think that theory falls apart because he's not in every episode. And so I'm like, okay, well, so am I supposed to think that some of these episodes are really happening and some of them aren't? Like, even some of the struggles he's not in, obviously. So does that make just part of that a dream? Like, I mean, we already know part of it is a dream. I don't want to really get deeply into this, but
no.
I was just curious. Like,
I think it was intriguing, the whole concept. The reality of that is that they didn't find out about it until season 11, so it wasn't in the others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't.
Yeah, we can make it whatever we want it to be, I think, to a certain extent, like anything else on the X-Files. It was right. Kind of a cool thing that once we started to pick up on it as viewers and fans, we started really freaking out when we'd see it again. And it was kind of a fun little sort of Easter egg hunt through the season.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that was just kind of a fun little activity for the fans to enjoy and to theorize about, which is always great. It's, you know, driving the fans crazy is, you know, always a fun thing to do because I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. I had one more observation I wanted to make about these documentaries before we kind of move into our next topic here. And it's actually quite a nice segue. So Jen, was there any other questions you had regarding the documentaries specifically that you wanted to ask?
I guess I was just kind of wondering as we were talking, and I'm not sure if you remember the sort of round figure, Julie, but do you have any recollection how many hours of footage you had to sort through to get down to, you know, the length, you know, whether it's a half hour, an hour and a half of these documentaries that you came up with?
Yeah, good question. I think I knew at one point, I'm sure I had 200 hours for season 10.
Yeah.
And that's only 6 episodes, right?
Right.
And I never worked on the, like, thought about the later season. So, yeah. But I also feel I shot, maybe that's not because there's 4 more episodes in season 11, but I feel like, a lot. It's because it's
a lot. A lot, yeah.
It's the B-roll. I feel like, you know, you shoot about an hour, maybe 2 hours if it's a really good day of B-roll, and then this plethora of interviews on set. And then later we did have access to some of the dailies. Like, it was a lot of material to cull from. So,
yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. Well, my next question about this, or just an observation that I made, I felt like a lot of these documentaries, which I'm sure is by design, was sort of through the lens on kind of female filmmaking. Because I really, really appreciated that, like, first of all, not only, like, they made a big deal about how they had some extra female writers in season 11 and they had a couple extra female directors. But I wasn't aware until I'm watching this documentary, like, how many major players in this show were female, like the stunt coordinator. Mm. There was, like, a lot of people in there, and I don't have their names in front of me, but there were several people, and a lot of the people that you interviewed were women. The documentary, like the season X and Sulfur X. And I noticed too, like, even when you were interviewing, you know, the Lone Gunman, they were great, but like their talk or their interview was sort of about, yeah, well, we thought this was sort of feminism. It was feminist of us to be here and, like, everyone's being free with their sexuality or whatever. I don't know, whatever they were saying. And I just, it was something I picked up as I was watching these documentaries. And that does, like, what you were just talking about lead me into my next question, which was going to be, as a female filmmaker, how did you get involved in working on this documentary about the Scully effect? How did that all come about? The concept of the Scully effect, all of that.
I guess, the nuts and bolts of that is that there was, because Fox kind of exists only within Disney now because they were absorbed. Right after, I think it was in 2018, like close to when X-Files, but they have a wing, or had a wing called Fox Social Impact, which is kind of what it sounds like, where they are trying to do some social good or promote sustainable filmmaking, things like that, with a lot of their titles. And if they can kind of bring attention to some of the things that they're doing, or they're looking to make featurettes. So, like, I'm sure you have, there are little PSAs that I ended up doing something for the greening, if that's the right word, green production of the X-Files set, which, they did an amazing job. Like, they hired a green consultant to make the whole production more sustainable.
I ended up
working with Fox Social, and it was kind of a, I enjoyed doing that because although it's about filmmaking still, it's still kind of a behind the scenes, but I don't know, it felt like it was something a little more on one level. Maybe it's a bit dull to talk about recycling, but on the other hand, it's about something, you know, like it's about an issue that I care about. And obviously I care about the Expo, so I also really, but, you know, making of, you know, you're making a movie, it's not brain surgery, or it's not. So it was just a little bit of a change. And I thought, maybe I can try to do something of that ilk next season. And, I'd heard of the Scully effect, or I'd read about it in the past, but I never really thought too deeply about it. And then I ended up, I think, my memory is I read a pretty good article about it not too long before I was starting to pitch to do season 11 special features. And I distinctly remember it was written by Abby Norman, who is actually in the Scully effect. She's an X-Files fan and she's a science writer, and she's a huge Scully fan. And so she kind of wrote about why it was important to her. And I was like, wow, this is great. And I feel like this can be a thing that more people should know about. Like, we as files know about it, but, and so I guess that's what I proposed to Social Impact, because I thought, hey, maybe we can find a way. Because the thing that Social Impact does was they usually went in conjunction with, like, for the film Hidden Figures, which was about the African-American mathematicians in NASA.
Yeah.
They did something in conjunction with that film where I think they helped create a scholarship fund for someone, or there have been, you know, ways of raising money. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, with Scully Effect, here we're talking about women in STEM and, you know, women in education, that kind of thing. And I knew that Jillian has a lot of charities that are close to her. So I thought maybe we can find a way to combine these things. And so that was my original show, what the Scully Effect is and talk about how cool she was. And then it kind of grew into something a little bit more with, like you were talking about female filmmakers, because it just kind of became a bit like a lot of my footage is about that and or about filmmaking. And so, and there was sort of, as you said, there was a bit of a brouhaha about female writers and directors. So I'm like, well, if we're going to address this, why don't we just talk about it on a grander scale? Because it is, I mean, it is a fact that there haven't been a lot on the X-Files.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and on a lot of other shows as well. It's like a broad issue that, you know, given our times and with the times of movement, like things are really starting to change. I'm seeing now, but only very, very recently from my experience, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. Would you say, I mean, other than obviously becoming a female filmmaker, was there an influence that the Scully Effect had on you back in the day when you watched the show originally?
Yeah, I mean, I never was probably conscious of it at the time, but I definitely identified with her more than, like, I love both characters, but I've always kind of been a really big Scully fan. And, you know, she was smart. She was a lot of things that are in that piece. Just we know why Scully's cool. Mm-hmm. And the whole medical background, you know, I think I was leaning that way in high school already. And so I do think that she influenced, and, you know, having talked to other fans, it seemed like this was a thing. Like I learned after the fact that one of my brother's good friends, his daughter's name, or her daughter's name is Jillian, because of Scully, you know. And, you know, wow. I think she's also in the science field and all these, like, someone that close, like, or 1 degree or 2 degrees away from, I didn't even know. But so, yeah, and I went into life sciences in university with the thought of becoming a doctor. And I have a very medical background family, so I was just kind of being pushed a little bit in that direction. even though I've always kind of wanted to, you know, I'm the only one in my family is like, I'm the black sheep of in the arts. So maybe there was a little bit of that in wanting to make the Scully, like the thing about, even though we're promoting STEM and even though I didn't go that way, but I'm kind of wanting to talk about, you know, X-Files was so important to me and I've told you why. And that led me, and I wouldn't have loved that show if not for her as well. So,
right.
And now, you know.
Cool.
Well, it's interesting too. It's like, it's obviously the effect that this has had on women and young women for decades is amazing. But the idea too, I find it so fascinating that a television show could have such an impact on so many people, and not just like, oh, I really like this show, but just like the direction of their lives and the way they feel about themselves, like their self-worth, and like, I can actually do this because Scully can do it. Like, that's amazing to me. And I mean, that's the show, like this television show did that. Like, that's crazy. And I mean, I think it was Anne Simon, or she was the one that I think you were interviewing, who said that, like, she was doing a class, teaching a class, and she was just like, what the heck? Let's just see. And she just put the feelers out and was like, how many of you are here, watched the X-Files, were fans of Dana Scully? And she's like, over half the people in my class raised their hand. That's amazing. I mean, and I know you wouldn't get that today, first of all, probably because there are so many more shows that it's impossible that everyone's watching the same thing. Back in the day, there were probably so many people watching the X-Files, but so many people watched so many shows that didn't have that kind of impact. And so mm-hmm. I just find that like even psychologically fascinating to bring that to light. It's amazing.
Yeah. This is a big thing. Like the thing that I thought was cool about getting to work on that was with like Fox's involvement, they are the ones who brought in the Gina Davis Center for Media Studies.
I was going to bring that up because that's a huge.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was a huge deal.
And I think there was another group, science group, like because, you know, we're talking about it and obviously I know people, so I believe that it's real, but, it people might dismiss it as being anecdotal of, it's not backed by science. So that's the thing that I thought was kind of nice for the piece, like, you know, we'll back up these claims by doing they actually went and did a proper survey to get the facts. And that's what Gina Davis's organization does, because in order for anyone to listen to her, she's like, the people will listen to the actual science. So
Scully herself would have approved Gina Davis' study.
That's kind of how I feel.
It was great. It's the first time I've ever seen actual hard facts to back up sort of the Scully effects. So that was a really great addition to the documentary, and just all the different people that you talk to. It just really did such an amazing job of really conveying this is a real thing, and it's like Annie said, it's having a real effect on people's lives. So I really liked all the different things you put together for that.
Yeah, one thing I was going to say that I was a little disappointed was that I wish that we had done more to talk to, you know, because I had a lot of people kind of self-record about their experiences about the Scully effect, because, you know, I can't travel to all across America or the world as it was.
Yeah.
And then how do you include those? Like, which pieces do you include? I had a few in that piece, but I mean, there's so many more, and I kind of like it's very specific in STEM fields, and who didn't get, you know, their moment in that piece. And I thought, you know, we have a lot of these. Wouldn't it be great if they could just say their bit and people could just watch their whole, you know, it wasn't really an interview, but whatever, their statement, you know? And unfortunately, they kind of got left on the cutting room floor, because I thought, oh, you know, maybe we can do that as part of this whole Scully effect campaign as well. There's so many.
The documentary itself is sort of quite short, really. It's only 15 minutes, and boy, it just flies by. There's a lot you need to try to convey in 15 minutes, and it must have been a real, real challenge to do that. So I can only imagine how much you wind up having to leave out of that, unfortunately, with the time limit you had.
And so many amazing bits of Scully being badass, I must say. Lots of great footage that you, again, enjoyable. A fan would be able to find and dig up. Just so great. So great.
Loved it. It's so enjoyable to watch.
I will show it to my daughter someday. She's only 8, so some of that stuff's a little scary and gory for her now.
Right.
But in a few years, I will be showing her that. So you are already having an impact, obviously.
I recommend, I think it just got on Netflix. It may just be on Netflix very recently, or I saw an ad, although it was made around the same time as I was making that short documentary about Scully effect, but it's called This Changes Everything.
I was
Have you seen it?
No, but I was just looking that up because I was doing my research, and it's one of those that I have on my list and I just keep forgetting it, but it is on Netflix. I was looking that up because I keep telling my husband, I'm like, we got to watch this. I really want to see this movie.
It's pretty interesting because I saw it at a film festival because it's only very recently released on Netflix, but it was made a couple years ago. And they start talking about, you know, how representation matters and female influence and stuff. And one of the details that I do think it's a good documentary, but their example was, they called it the CSI effect. And I'm like, Scully did that well before CSI.
Yeah, no, we can't have that.
Like, come on.
No.
You know, maybe the movie was made, or was that part was made before they realized about Scully. And then they made a big deal out of the Scully
really
effect.
Believe.
Yeah. To
if you just waited like 6 months, you would have done that study. And then they interviewed Jillian in that documentary, and you know, don't talk to her at all about that. Like, I think she has one very brief soundbite, and I was like, opportunity lost. Well,
thank goodness we have your documentary, Julie, for the record, so that we know what the truth is on the Scully effect. So
that is a shame, though. That is a shame. Because it's shame. Like, yeah, I mean, the CSI, that doesn't even really have anything to do with women. I guess there's women on that show, obviously. I've never seen it.
It's not the same.
It's about not seeing women in forensic positions. Yeah. And I guess there's something. A large jump in. Enrollment and that kind of thing. So there is evidence, so I'm going to use that. And there are good, really interesting little details.
Cool.
I've
got to watch that one.
It's really, it's kind of depressing.
Oh, I know. It's like, it's one of those disheartening things, like, really? Oh my God, really? Yeah, I can already tell. Maybe that's why I'm kind of been putting it off. Okay, Julie, unless there's anything else you wanted to say about the Scully effect, I would love, and I know Jen would too, to talk to you about Plus One. Because you apparently have some interesting tidbits that maybe you could share about being on set during that infamous bed scene of Mulder and Scully. And because I think you and I were sharing a brief little conversation about I had made a tweet just like a joke. I'm not there. I don't know. I'm just making assumptions of like Kevin Hooks, the director, and Duchovny having like a little conversation. And then Chris is in the background like kind of like... overseeing all right, we gotta make sure no one's gonna kiss, heaven forbid, we can't have anyone kissing. Like, what was the vibe of that like? Do you remember, could you share anything about that? I would love to hear.
There's some interesting stuff that I'm a shipper as well, so that was I would say the filming of that whole, all the Mulder Scully scenes from that episode was a major highlight for me. And how I was saying, like, I stand back and I'll get out of the way. And like, I was like, you know what, if there's going to be a scene that I'm going to like stand my ground and just be here, I'm going to like cover this. And, I guess the interesting thing about that scene what I find interesting, and I did actually listen to your Plus One episode. I don't know when it was, but
we don't know.
I don't either.
Yeah, it was sometime.
But you were asking all these questions. I'm like, oh, it's interesting. Like, I found it really interesting what you were, the trajectory of what you thought each line meant and those kinds of things. I'm like, oh, well, I thought that you were pretty spot on. I mean, I don't know. Like, I didn't.
Nice.
Or the questions that you were having, like, well, then they got their idea across is kind of how I thought, like what they were intending, then that's that it worked. But usually on a film set, the kind of the process is, you're about to film a scene. And so the director goes in with the actors and they kind of do a private blocking, how they're going to work it. I'm going to go stand there and blah, blah, blah. And they acted. And once they've kind of worked that out, you bring in the crew. For crew blocking, everyone watch, like, then they just kind of go through the motions and, the camera assistants make their, like, place the marks on the ground for where the actors need to stand for the camera. And then that allows them to light and set up for that scene. And, that's how most shows do it. On X-Files, at least in season 10, in my memory, there wasn't private blocking, so like it was just kind of crew blocking, which again, kind of great because you kind of got to watch a lot of again as a fan. I don't know how they acted, well, they did it that way, but on Plus One it was private, and so I thought, oh, I'm gonna miss. But I understood that it's kind of an intimate scene kind of thing. And then when they brought in the crew to show, then whatever conversations they were having before crew blocking, I guess they weren't finished, because there was quite an analysis that went on during the, because they're just lying on a bed. There's not much, there's no marks to, like, they're in one position.
They're just kind of waiting around. Yeah.
Right. But within that, like, they have their conversation, they're facing, well, as it is in the episode, facing both of their faces are towards camera, like, very, I want to believe kind of scene. And, whenever she says that line, whatever the last line, what if we lose our jobs or something like that? Yeah. Then what would we do? And
we'll think of something.
We'll think something. Oh yeah, there you go. So that was the bit that they were trying to work out. And I don't know if David and Jillian did something. She turned to him like, "We'll think of something." And they were gonna. I think David asked like, "So then what? What are we thinking of? Like, what something are we like? Are we gonna kiss or that kind of thing?" And Kevin didn't see it that way. Like, I think he saw it as a conversation. It's like, no, you're too close, kind of thing. And I don't think Chris was in the room yet, but there was sort of a debate of what, how much do you imply or not in that?
Yeah.
And, you know, as you know, with this show, it's usually very chaste, like, you know, it's either very chaste or no, it's always very chaste.
It's funny, yeah. Because I don't mean to interrupt, just very briefly, a kiss there feels like it would have been very appropriate in most normal TV language. But in The X-Files, a kiss in bed has so many more layered meanings. And I understand what you're saying, weirdly, like how big of a deal this would be for the tone and makeup of this show. I do like that they're sitting there debating whether or not to have a kiss. That's interesting information.
I'm glad it came close.
But
yeah.
I get what you're saying.
It was a question, but
at least it came
then
up.
They got, the idea was like, well, like, you know, there has to be some suggestion. Like, she's clearly suggesting something. We'll think of something. That's how I interpret.
Oh, yeah.
It's not clear. But, and you also want to do the tease because it's that the doppel, you were asking about like script details.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, the camera, it's written in the script like that camera pans off on that line and lands on her doppelganger. Mm-hmm. And so the doppelganger sees what we can't. Kind of.
Yes.
Thing, right?
I feel like I saw that on Tumblr or something. It's implied in the script. Very, it's spelled out there.
So you get to see from doppelganger Scully's reaction, you know. Like,
yeah.
So strange.
No, it's bizarre.
And then the next scene is, you know, the after, like, them in bed.
Yeah,
right?
All of the implications, in my opinion, are they come after. Like,
yes, yeah.
Beforehand,
so that was
yeah, it could book. Be, I just mean beforehand, it could be anything. Like, they could literally be like, oh, well, they gave each other a hug and went to sleep. Great.
Exactly.
Yeah. But all of the stuff that's very, I would say, as explicit as this show gets is the aftermath, which continue, sorry.
Right. So that's where this whole, a fair bit of debating, I thought, occurred, where it was like, well, now what? So, again, I think in the script, she's in his arms. So, but again, it's implied, it's like, so what? Did they, didn't they?
Yeah.
It's very still unclear. And I think this was the debate. It's like, well, how vague do you want it to be? Or do you want to just like be explicit about it or not? Like, what are we trying to tease here? Right. And I think that was where everyone had an opinion, where it's just like, oh, just, they slept with each other. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, or is there another way to suggest that rather than keeping it kind of vague with the, she's sleeping in his arms and he has, oh, and then there was the logical logistics issue of he has to get out to go to the washroom. And I think David said, well, you know, if I have to get out and she's like, how am I going to physically get out without, he didn't find that believable.
Without
that
waking her up or something.
Without
yeah.
waking her up.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. And so he rejected that idea. I think that's how that, and then it's like, well, then what are we going to do? And I think Kevin was of the argument that's like, just, I think it's okay to reveal that you've had sex or something like that. And then there was a suggestion of, oh, maybe we should flop sides, and then that's an implication, like, what happened, like, that that's even more you know.
Yes but that's,
I thought it was a good idea.
It's a really good idea, because there's no innocent explanation for that, like,
yeah.
You're not
yes.
gonna just be like, you know what, let me just climb over you, I think I'd prefer to be on the other side,
I'd rather be on that side.
Yeah
no.
But it's still,
and they knew we would notice.
Yeah, and it's still, but it's still, like you're saying, it's just vague enough. It's just quote unquote chaste enough. We can make the suggestion without actually showing anything, but
right.
It's pretty clear cut. Like, the evidence is here. As Scully would say, the answers are there. You just need.
Exactly.
But yes, okay, I love that. All
so
right.
There is that on top. But in my opinion, I think that what Chris was hoping for was to keep it as, like, you tease it out as long as possible until, like, it's confirmed by the afterglow line.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So,
well, Anne Scully is
like, no.
Naked. Like,
well, that, but that wasn't originally the
plan. Oh, oh, okay.
So, you know, like, because she was supposed, as far as I know, they were in bed. She's like, her arm is around him. That was what was originally scripted, and that's what they were like setting up for. And then David said the thing. What did I just say?
Getting up to get out.
I can't get out. So then they gave that idea. I was like, let's flop positions. And maybe it was this point. I'm sorry, I'm getting things out of order, but because I don't want to, I'm not trying to like say, damn you, Kevin Hooks, or anything like that. But like, I think it was that was his idea at that point. Once they flopped, and it's like, well, what's the situation with the clothing? And so that picture that you posted on whatever, like, they were actually debating, like, what is our state of undress in this scene?
So then I take off my tank top, or like, what? Yeah, like, Mulder's still dressed and Scully isn't, which is a source of contention among many.
And so Kevin suggested she not have her, or like that, or a shoulder is revealed or something.
Right.
He was like, okay, you know, that will, like, and they were all in the room. Was like, well, that's for sure. Now you know something.
Yeah.
And
was very significant.
I think it was a discussion with Chris about whether that's going too far or not. But, you know, he went for it. So as much as we say that, you know, good for, you know.
Thank goodness.
Look, both Jen and I, we give Chris a hard time jokingly. We think he is a secret shipper. He's just protecting his vision.
Yeah.
And I think it's fine. Like, it is what it is. Like you said, it is what it is. We're not going to get it spoon-fed to us in exactly the way we're used to on every other television show, because this isn't like every other show. And these are all such thoughtful things that you're saying. Like, these are decisions that this show would probably have to make, whereas other ones probably just like, whatever, just roll her over and get out.
Show it all.
Yeah, like, they don't have to think about
this
stuff.
This is a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, whereas, and I think that to certain fans, I think David and Julian really got that, and Kevin coming in new to X-Files maybe was less aware how big a deal it was until this conversation really came in. So he was like, you know, you slept together.
What's the big
deal?
Like, well.
Like, oh, my God. Yeah,
how much
like,
time do you have, Kevin?
Oh, this is a very big deal.
But then to his credit, he's the one pushing for that, which I think is a nice thing, right? Like, that we ended up getting.
Yeah.
And to Chris's credit, or, you know, on his side, I totally get what he's trying to do, which is he's delaying, you know, the reveal.
Well, he did the same thing
about the reveal, right?
And I Want to Believe. And it was very, very proud of that. And I mean, it was worth it, because I remember that moment in the theater when you hear Mulder talking, you see Scully sleeping, and then you see him pop up behind her and everyone freaks out. But you're watching this scene for a good 30, 45 seconds, maybe even a minute before that happens. And like, it's the same idea. It's like, we're going to delay and delay and delay until, oh, now we have our proof. Now we have our evidence. So I love that you're, that is
the line. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think that was what the, exactly. Now we have her. It was kind of like confirmation upon confirmation or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
And then the other interesting detail was about like, who will be in what state of undress. And they were like, if he has his undershirt off, we're analyzing this. And
oh, this is what we do here, Julie.
Oh, this is all good. Yeah.
If he had his, like, it's too obvious. Like, he can't go to the bathroom and, like, that's too grand to tell. Whereas if she's covered and then it slips, like, it's a more subtle reveal.
It's a slow reveal. Yeah. Cause we don't see her
yet,
because the sheet was like all the way up to her neck. And okay, this makes more sense, because the idea that you're giving, this is just like a slow rollout of the reveal. You're right. If he gets out,
just a series. Yeah.
Yep. If he gets out and he doesn't have a shirt on,
and he's,
you immediately know.
It's slow cutting, right?
I love
that. Exactly. Yeah. But there is just like each one is a little tidbit that builds on the previous one. So yeah, that's really cool, actually, the way it's structured.
Mm-hmm. And then the other just kind of funny detail is that, so he has his undershirt on, he comes back, he sees his doppelganger, comes running back out, and there was this issue where they had already shot the scene when he fights himself, because, you know, you shoot out of sequence in television all the time. And when he's fighting himself, he's got his shirt on, but he has no undershirt on, like, he's bare-chested and it's like half buttoned. And they're like, for continuity, he has to actually take that undershirt off when he runs out of the room.
Right.
Which I thought was like ironic, kind of funny. Why would you, you know, if you really wanted to get out of there?
Well, but, I know.
So David had to figure out a way to make it natural, which I thought was interesting, to like, as he's changing, to make sure that that got off so that later that scene would make sense.
And it never struck me as odd in any way that he was taking off his shirt at that moment. I mean, it did seem slightly odd that it wasn't off sooner, but the fact that he was taking it off at that moment just seemed totally fine. And, you know, like, any time David's taking his shirt off, I'm never going to question it, but it always seemed to to work really well. So it never even occurred to me that that was for continuity purposes. But that's kind of cool.
I don't think I ever would have noticed that if you hadn't brought it up, because I certainly never noticed it before. And we have definitely analyzed this scene ad nauseum.
I'm going to notice that now. The connection between that and the fight scene, having to have that continuity is interesting.
But I think that helps because it adds to the urgency. It makes that scene better. So
yeah, it just works.
Yeah.
So that's kind of that. And then I remember, Jen, you had mentioned that you liked that line, how many L's in Scully? Is that what the line is?
Yeah. How many L's in Scully?
That was a good ad. I remember, because it was just how many L's in Scully.
Or wait, maybe he said how many letters in Scully. Something like that. Yeah.
I think, something like that. Yeah.
Whatever that line is.
Yeah. That was a cute
one. When he said it, he got to continue adding every day.
Yeah. That really makes a difference. Because there's something about the rhythm of the line, like how many letters in Scully. I love that.
Keeping that scene, I mean, it's already funny with the afterglow line, but it's like keeping Mulder sort of heightened in his comic space, in his comedic space, I think makes that scene. So I think that was a really good choice by David. I love it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I do love that episode. I think that's such a good episode.
That was so interesting. I was fascinated by those tidbits.
I was absolutely riveted, I have to tell you.
Yeah, that was awesome.
We literally, even the tiniest morsels, and those I think were very big, juicy morsels.
They were tasty.
I love that because I feel like everything about what they did makes sense logically and emotionally. For the scene. I really enjoyed that.
That was an excellent analysis.
And I think that what was done at the end, which is in the making of documentary, it kind of changed.
The final scene.
Because I was looking at that before, and even that changed. And I definitely give credit to David for kind of figuring out a quicker, faster way to end the episode.
That was so great.
But what I remember, maybe I'm remembering wrong, but when I first read it, it was a little bit different. And then it changed again, in my opinion, for the worse. And then it changed to what it is. And the first version is closer to the last version than the middle one. I don't know where it got kind of... I think it was... David mentions it in the documentary about how there was sort of this running theme that they didn't... They ended up kind of cutting out where Mulder kind of kept checking out Scully's ass.
Yeah. I remember... seeing parts of that and being like, yeah.
And then, or she maybe, they were kind of ogling each other the episode, which they cut out, to be fair. But
Not all of it. Maybe that was just David and Jillian, but there's quite a bit of that in that episode.
Because it had been David's note, I think, when he saw that, he was like, well, if I'm going to be doing all that, she should be, objectifying me.
Yeah.
And so she should come in. So when it got rewritten, she was supposed to kind of open the door and sneak a look at him. Mm. Whereas in my memory, the first version was she rejects him, he goes into the room, and then you stay with him, with her, and then the door opens and she says the line, extreme.
Oh, yeah, not the out realm of the realm extreme, of extreme possibility.
And then I don't know if she enters, but it's implied again.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, that's a variation in a way of what is just kind of the flopped.
Right.
And the episode ends on the look, which is kind of perfect. But I also wanted fans to see that there was a version where
she goes in.
When they played it, that was how she goes in.
Yeah. And I wonder, too.
That's interesting.
When I watch it, because I've seen, obviously, the version where the door closes, where she goes in and the door closes. I don't know. I feel like I like how it is. I like ending on David's smile and then it just cuts. And then they have that ridiculous unsheathing noise that I still scream about every time I see it. I'm like, who allowed this? It's great, but it just makes me laugh.
I prefer the actual episode ending as they longer. I think at the time, I was like, go in there, Scott.
I feel like the unsheathing thing was like their little okay, here's our confirmation. We got stuff going on. But I thought that was so cute because, like you said, in both of the other versions that they considered, it was more, I mean, we wanted Scully to, like David said, we wanted Scully to sort of be the subject or the object, whichever, I'm getting these mixed up, but the one who makes the, I can't think of my words right now, who goes after him. There we go.
Move.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the version that we have, we also get him going to her too. It's just happening on the other side of the door. Like he's anticipating. So it's, it is, we are with her. We see her, you know, going after him. But then when he opens the door, it's revealed to us that they're meeting in the middle. And I think that's perfect. I really love the way
they're both up for it, which is great.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome.
Nice.
Well, there was one more thing that I wanted to talk to you about. One really important thing was this Ghoulie.net thing that came out when Ghoulie, well, it was right before season 11 started airing, I believe. And this was like Jackson's little blog or his website that was dropping all these interesting clues. We don't really know what's clues, but you were responsible for a great deal of this, correct? What exactly was your involvement in it?
So I'm pretty sure what it was, it went online, that website, season 11 episodes aired on Wednesdays, right? Or something like that.
I think so.
Yeah.
It still feels a bit weird to me. It's like, this is a Friday night show or Sunday.
Exactly. I can only accept Fridays and Sundays. Wednesday was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if it was Wednesday, I think on the Monday or whatever at the beginning of that week, that was kind of our goal, was to launch that site a little bit ahead of time, whether people discovered it or not. I think Fox might have even hinted, or they did a little promo for the episode, leaked that this website existed. But so Jim was kind of ahead of all. He had finished a draft of his episode fairly early, because you know, it wasn't it was the fifth episode and it was filmed in the Fifth Order. But he had a draft from the moment I came to Vancouver. And then one day I was like, I think on the first day I was in the office, Mark Freeborn, who's the production designer, is like, hey, did Jim talk to you about that thing that you're going to do? And I'm like, what thing am I going to do? And he's like, you know, that, like, I had no idea. Like, I didn't even know. He says that you'll know what to do. And so I asked, I think.
No pressure.
I got in touch with him and he said, oh, well, you know, read the episode, you'll understand. But they talk about a website, and his whole idea was inspired by the Slender Man. Myth or lore, and that was a very popular, famous, you know, I don't know if you know creepypasta.
Yeah.
So it's definitely influenced by that. And so Jim thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if we kind of did our own version, something like creepypasta, and that it's just full of scary stories. I think that was kind of what he was like, you know, X-Files has a big fanfic community and all that. Something like that, which it's not quite what it ended up being. But I think he liked the interactive idea of it, because that's what Creepypasta is like, and that other people could contribute or build upon. And so I kind of went, and he's like, we should build this in real life. And Julie, you're the big X-Files fan, so this seems like a project that would be fun for you. And I mean, yes, it was, obviously. So that was, but then I kind of, really kind of took it apart, because you start reading the script and it's like, well, Mulder and Scully are saying that there's this guy who's posting, you know, like, clearly William is contributing to this creepypasta or to Ghoulie.net. And maybe it's implied in the actual script that it was his website. Yes.
Or it was at Reaver, like all the Reaver, ones that were at Reaver. Yeah.
And so we thought, well, what if we spin it more that it's his kind of blog, and that, you know, he seems like a pretty troubled kid, so maybe there's a way to, you know, make this beyond just like telling, you know, little urban myths and that kind of thing, which, you know, would have been fun to just write little short things. But I was like, you know, I'm the X-Files fan, so I want to write things that link to the X-Files more specifically. So I kind of like that idea of that, you know, maybe he uses this blog as, you know, even if it's as fiction or as Reaver or writing as other characters, that he's kind of getting out some of his issues, and people can choose or not to reveal, or influenced by his past. And not just Reaver. And then, you know, just kind of doing fun stuff like shoot timing on these girls. So maybe, and they seem to know about Ghoulie when they were on that boat. So I'm like, oh, well, we'll get someone to write in the voice of like a teenage girl and throwing in other little bits and pieces. And I think the stories, every story has some like stupid, obscure. It's too bad because I think that website's down now. It just kind of disappeared off the.
Yeah, it's been archived somewhere. I'm looking at it right now. So I'm people have saved it. I don't think all of it is there, but some of it is there.
Because we, you know, and I liked this idea of the interactivity. And it wasn't just stories when I first, because if he is like a sighting thing or a monster, we were like, oh, well, maybe it can be people who think they have, it's like a Bigfoot thing where you have photos and all these kinds of, right. Like, at the end of the day, we didn't have a whole lot of time, money to put towards that. So, but text, that's something you can kind of. So they wanted to create a real site and then kind of in the anal retentiveness of it all, like to come up with it, like, because it's going to be on screen. Like Mulder and Scully are actually looking at the websites. And because they brought me in early, I'm like, okay, well, whatever they look at obviously has to look exactly like that when it goes live. And then when they're scrolling, there has to be some content on that that will match to, because, you know, we're filming months and months before it actually airs. And so that was sort of one of my kind of side gigs, which was to, you know, I proposed to how it should look and definitely influenced by the Creepypasta website. And then I thought, well, how many stories do we, like, how much are they going to actually scroll? How much would they actually see? And, you know, I didn't design this, you know, the other thing about working in film and TV, they make the thing to make, like, it's not a functional site. Like, it just does what you need it to do. Like,
right.
Yeah. It's just got to scroll up and down. That's all.
Yeah.
So I asked the computer playback guys, like, how many stories do you think you would see when they're scrolling up and down? They're like, oh, give us 10 titles or something. So that was sort of a fun thing where I had to come up with story titles that are kind of ridiculous. All of them are really outrageous.
Did you write these? Did you write all of these stories?
I wrote about 80% of them.
Wow.
And
wow.
But all we needed was, like, the way the website's designed is, like, it has the title, like, the person who posted it, and then, like, the first paragraph of the story. And then, like, if you want to keep reading, you would hit continue.
Right.
So I'm like, all I really need right now is just to come up with some wacky title, write the first paragraph, and then you'll deal with it later. And that was kind of how I dealt with it at the time, because there's such going on that I'm like, this is kind of a fun write. Like, it's like, you know, creative writing class kind of where. So Mike and I, like, were throwing around, just give me these wacky titles. We'll figure out what the story is. Like, I kind of knew I had certain ideas, but I knew I could kind of, like, punt the football down a little bit for later. Kind of. And so that's what we did, and, you know, pick the order. And then when eventually the company that Fox hired to implement the actual website, like that, so I was an intermediary between that to make sure. It's like, you got to make sure the dates are the same and, you know, like that kind of thing. I probably hated me. But, like, I'm like, if it's not, like, the same, it, like, it has to match. Or, you know, you're trying to bring the real world. And the other thing was the interactivity aspect of it, which I don't know how well that worked. Or because, you know, anyone could post their own stories. And, you know, I didn't really keep up. And that also needed to have a moderator to keep that going. So it wasn't fully sustainable, I don't mean that.
I remember thinking it was really cool. Like, there was a lot of content on there, so much that even myself, who's a huge X-File, I didn't read all of it. I read some of it, and I was curious. My question about it would be, was any of this read or had to be approved by Chris Carter, or was this all just sort of from your own interpretation of what Jackson / William, what he would be thinking or dreaming? Like, I'm just I'm curious, like, is this quote unquote canon? Like, is this sanctioned by Chris, I guess, would be my question.
So I would argue that, you know, I don't know for sure if Chris read everything, you know, because you're right, there's a lot of content.
It's in a the lot end.
I think the thing that was, I'm like, well, you have to put a lot or else people are going to think it's lame, is kind of how I thought of it.
It looks more, like, real, you know, like the more you have
people
on there. But
Gabe Rodder, who is one of the producers and kind of Chris's right-hand man on the revivals. He was fairly quite involved, so a lot of them went through him. And because it was Jim's, based on Jim's episode, they were giving feedback. But they also kind of let, I basically pulled from what was existing. So in a way, I view it kind of like fiction in the sense that I wouldn't necessarily call it canon. It's more like my headcanon, some of the stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not even that, because I feel like it's just him working out things with what little backstory I have of what they've revealed. Like, it's not revealed on the show, or there's no evidence that, you know, he grew up in a farm in Wyoming, right? Like, so take the stories as you will. A lot of it is probably gibberish from me and my friends.
I love it.
Really cool.
Some of the details too, like there was one in particular I really liked, the one that was called Dream Disease Apocalypse, which is a really cool title, by the way.
Yeah.
But the fact that not only is it, you know, we see that it's by Jackson William, but the date is December 22nd, 2017. And I mean, that's obviously 5 years after the fated end of the world thing. But I was like, oh, well, somebody knows what they're doing here, because they put that date on there very specifically about the apocalypse. I just like the little
clues.
That
was very clever of me. I don't remember that at all.
Very clever of you.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. And they just think things about, like, oh, I see these things in my visions, like the blue-eyed doctor, blah, 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 blah. Like things that you're like, okay, well, this makes sense that he would be having all these thoughts but have no idea what he's seeing. I do love all this insight into the Jackson William character. I think it was a really good idea, and I remember thinking
very
that at the
cool.
time. So, you know,
yeah, I
well
mean,
done.
I wish that there was maybe more. I'm very happy because they gave a lot of free rein and they were happy with it. But if there was little, you know, because it's all like maybe or dream interpretation, that kind of thing, whereas. If Jim himself had written, because he talked for a while about writing a couple himself, but it didn't end up happening. So I guess that's what's in my mind. Like, oh, I kind of wish he had, because then it would be in my mind for real.
Yeah, I have a question that just suddenly came to my mind that I'm curious, because you talk to Jim clearly on set a lot, probably during this. Did you know? I mean, nobody knew at the time that My Struggle 4 was essentially going to undo a lot of what James Wong had so beautifully done in Ghoulie. And I'm saying that. You don't have to agree or disagree. You can remain unbiased. But that's my feelings on the matter. And I actually don't hate My Struggle 4 like a lot of people do. I think there are parts of it that are great. But I think there are things that were done with Ghoulie that I thought were so beautiful. And it would have been a perfect way to just end that William storyline. Do you ever remember hearing anything after, like, from James himself about how he felt about that, about like how he felt about how this My Struggle 4 script is essentially sort of stomping on his beautiful ending? Like, I'm being a little,
I have to admit, no, I genuinely don't know what is his opinion, because the one thing about Jim is he also works on American Horror Story.
Right.
And so he kind of takes a leave from American Horror Story to work on X-Files. So kind of like a satellite, like he kind of comes in and comes out. So once he was done Ghoulie, or not,
he'd be right off.
Nothing Lasts Forever. He was kind of off. So I wasn't interacting with him. And I don't think he was involved in them. Well, I don't think anybody really knew. That was the thing, because everyone knew that the last episode was going to be about William, but that's all we knew. Like,
yeah,
and that's kind of like that was sort of the lead ups. Like, Ghoulie is sort of a teeing up, and this website hopefully will help, because the last one that we did was kind of a tease for My Struggle 4, if I recall. And I think that one was the only one that was written after I actually knew what was happening in that episode,
right?
So,
right.
And the rest is a lot of spike plot. Like, it's all just based on things that have been suggested or implied previous episodes and to
I just wonder too how much was in flux in that in between time between Ghoulie and My Struggle 4, even in the writing of it. I just find that fascinating. But yeah, someday that's a
very
question.
Cool.
It's a question for Chris Carter someday. Well, Julie, this was so fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on with us. Is there anything else that you wanted to add, Jen, Or any questions that you have?
I just want to say how happy I am to hear that this whole amazing journey that Julie took us all on started on Alt TV X-Files, because that was my obsession through most of the 90s, was to hang out on Alt TV X-Files every Friday night and Sunday night and through most of the week. And I would print out reams of stuff from it to read. So nice. I'm so stoked to hear and also really kind of freaked out and excited to hear that really there actually were people from the show hanging out there occasionally too. So yeah. I'm just really excited to hear that this all came from that. And so I appreciate hearing all that information, and shout out to everyone that's still around that was hanging out back in the day on Alt TV X-Files.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it was, well, obviously, Glenda, I know that I think Frank Sputnik's also.
So exciting. This is like amazing. I'm so excited to hear that. You know, it's just so great to be able to learn new things about things that happened like 25 years ago in my life. And I love learning this kind of stuff. It's great.
I mean, for them, that was the Twitter of the 90s, yeah, right?
So, it was. Yeah. It was the place to be.
To be able to get.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. Yeah. It was, those were good times.
Julie, why don't you let our listeners know what you're up to now and if you have anything to plug?
I have anything to plug. Although I haven't seen it myself, I work as the on-set videographer person, behind the scenes person on Star Trek Discovery.
My husband is very excited when I saw that on your IMDb page, just as an aside, and he's a huge Star Trek Discovery fan. And when I told him that you were the on-set videographer, he was very excited about that. So just to let you know, you're appreciated not just for your X-Files connection, but that was a very exciting addition to our household.
Oh, cool. Well, you know, it's a fun show to be on. I myself am not. I'm an X-File.
Yeah. Fair enough. Me too. Me too.
But yeah. I actually am not a huge Trekkie one way or the other. I mean, I like it fine, but I know that there are people like us. So that's sometimes I'm filming. I'm like, you know, there are people who need to see this. Like, but I don't actually control the output. I'm just filming for the most part. I think there's a small thing that I may have cut that makes the season 3 DVD. Or Blu-ray, if anyone still actually buys physical media.
They're out there.
Yes. Yeah. That is out. Nice. I've just completed something that I'm kind of excited about, but can't really talk about yet, but it's an episode of a docu-series that hopefully will end up on Netflix maybe by the end of the year. I don't know.
Nice. And, keep us informed and we'll tweet out about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, speaking to what we were talking about, the Scully Effect, Star Trek Discovery, and another project that I'm working on, it's just interesting. Within a few years, I guess, what's the word? The look of the film crews have changed, or at least on these two shows that I happen to be on. You know, so a lot of female representation and diversity, and it's kind of... maybe I'm hyper aware of it because I had been kind of analyzing it from the other.
Yeah.
So I do think it's...
But I think that's true.
That's cool.
I hear that. That, like, not, you know, not just from you. I've been hearing that around, that from other... I also work in television, so I hear that. And I think that's really good. This is a change that's happening right now.
Nice.
So...
things are moving in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Julie. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will be back with you in a couple weeks. In the meantime, please do tweet at us at XFDpodcast on Twitter. We want to hear anything that you have to say about today's episode or anything X-Files related, really. And we will catch up with you on the next episode of X-Files Diaries.